Cody and Charlie and a few of their friends chug a couple beers and talk politics. It's better when you're two beers in.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Two Beers In, a tipsy political roundtable. My name is Charlie Todd.
And I'm Cody Lindquist.
We are a married couple who loves politics, who loves drinking beer, so we decided to combine the two and do a podcast. We do a live show at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater, which is just down the street at 555 West 42nd Street.
Hell's Kitchen, what?
We live in Hell's Kitchen.
Yeah.
And for those listening on the podcast, we are live from the Hell's Kitchen Democratic Club in the Ellington Room at Manhattan Plaza.
Guys. The Ellington Room got a makeover, and it's huge.
Beautiful backsplash.
This is some local politics. If you're in the podcast, skip ahead 15 seconds. I just want to give a shout-out to the Ellington Room. Great job.
It looks great. But we do a show once a month at UCB. We have one on Wednesday, September 11th. We've got writers from The Daily Show, Late Night with Seth Meyers. Correspondent from Vice News Tonight, and a producer from Samantha Bee who will be there. But tonight, we are here at the Hell's Kitchen Democratic Club interviewing our state senator. Please welcome Brad Hoylman.
Thank you so much for having me.
We are so excited. Charlie and I are like super big geeks. So the tagline at the end of our podcast is vote in midterm elections.
Wow.
Charlie and I vote in every single election. If there's an election at a library to vote, we vote for every community thing. We are on top of it. So we are very excited.
My question is, have you voted for the new New York State license plate?
It's got to be that Cuomo bridge. We got to give the governor what he wants and give him that Cuomo bridge, right? We have not voted for that, but there is a lot of speculation that there's multiple Statue of Liberty license plates that are probably put up there to cancel out the vote so the Cuomo bridge wins.
Okay. What are you for? This is the first question, then. What are you for?
Wow. Which one am I for? You know, I don't have a car, so unless I get a license plate... Unless I put a license plate on a city bike or a baby carriage, I'm kind of out of business.
You are totally our favorite state senator right now. It's the same, samesies. Although, I think we should, I would be game for stealing a slogan from another state. I think we should be third in flight, right? Don't Ohio and North Carolina fight over that? Let's just New York get in on it.
Third in flight. We also, before we really get started here, we do want to once again thank Single Cut for hooking us up with the beer. We are drinking Pets or Hop Sounds, a Pet Sounds parody beer, which is a very hoppy Kolsch. So Single Cut in Queens, we love our local beer. Brad, I wanted to start out with an issue that is actually very important to me, which is the floating billboard that's been floating in the Hudson River.
Can I just interrupt really quickly? We were... where were we at the other day with our kids?
Blues Festival, the Blues.
We were at the Blues Festival, and we're having this lovely afternoon with our two children, and I hear Charlie go, "Motherfucker!" like really loudly, and I was like, oh my God, someone died, our son broke a leg, and then he was yelling at a billboard floating in the Hudson.
Not only that, I was tweeting because Wicked, the musical, was advertising this billboard, and they've been advertising on it, and they're a good local business, Wicked, the musical, over on 50th Street, but they should stop advertising on this illegal billboard. If you don't know this issue, those of you in the room or those of you listening, there's a company called Ballyhoo Media. They started in Miami where they were polluting the waters of Miami with a digital billboard that would cruise by. And now, this summer, they've been in the Hudson River and the East River, and our state senator, Brad Hoylman, just got them banned, which we're very excited about, because I don't think you should have to look at advertising when you're sitting by our beautiful Hudson River Park, our Riverside Park. But what I wanted to ask you, Senator Hoylman, is what is going on with the situation? Because this CEO is writing like op-eds in the Daily News. He's saying that he's going to flout the ban, but the ban doesn't actually ban him. What's up?
I know. You know, I guess that's the attitude you have when the name of your company is called Ballyhoo. Like, you think you can just flout the law and get away with it. You know, I'm very pleased that, like, this issue is the kind of issue that it demonstrates what it's like having a new Senate Democratic majority, because, you know, it's a quality of life issue that downstaters really feel, that city representatives really understood. We would have never gotten this bill, you know, past the first square under Republican majority. But I was able to introduce it with Assemblymember Dick Gottfried. We passed it in the last days of session. It just makes sense. The city had been trying to take this company to court. And, who knows how long that was going to take. So we stepped in, worked with the city, and said, why don't we just ban it at the state level? And these are the kinds of things we can do now. When the city can't do something because of their limited jurisdiction, the state of New York can step in, and that's what we did. So in terms of Ballyhoo, I guess my response is, see you in court. And in the meantime, you're going to be paying $5,000 for every single violation. Now,
How do we report them? Does Charlie's tweet count as an active report?
I think it does.
Because he will hang out in the Hudson and tag whoever needs to tag.
I think Charlie, maybe this is like a new kind of line of work,
He loves to ride his bike on the West Side Highway. He will just go up and down taking.
I just want 10% of each $5,000 fine, and I'm there.
It's a good idea. We have that law at the local level. If, you see an idling bus, for example, you can get a portion of the proceeds. We should fix Ballyhoo and share something of the proceeds with concerned citizenry, i.e. Charlie, and allow him to get a cut.
But this guy's argument is that, he's not a flashing billboard? He's not a digital billboard?
His argument is that he reads the legislation incorrectly. He says that that's his argument.
But you wrote a bill specifically to ban this guy, and his response is,
he's like, it doesn't apply to me. I'm like, well, actually, we wrote it specifically to apply to you. I mean, it couldn't be any more clear. So, Look, there's so many, we've said things like his business plan is sunk, his argument holds no water. it's almost comical how wrong he is. The fact that he had an op-ed printed in a reputable newspaper must have been because, there was space available. Kind of like there's going to be on his billboards when this is finally resolved.
So, let's give a round of applause for that. So while we're talking about the West Side and while we're talking about the Hudson, I wanted to bring up something else that you've recently pushed for that got accomplished, which was reducing the speed limit on the West Side Highway, also known as 12th Avenue, reducing it from 35 miles an hour to 30 miles an hour and adding some additional safety measures like longer crossing times for pedestrians. Applause from the room for that. Yeah. From all of the Hell's Kitchen residents here. So I'm curious, a lot of those safety measures were sort of in lower Manhattan in terms of the crossing times. Can we take this further? Can we take away a lane from the West Side Highway and widen our nation's busiest bike lane and maybe plant some trees? What's next for the West Side Highway?
It's a great idea. When I was in the Senate Democratic minority, I had no legislative power, so I had to look around for ideas of things I could do that didn't involve passing bills. So I had met this couple who had lost a son who was crossing the West Side Highway about 5 years ago, and was struck and killed by a hit and run driver. And they had walked up and down the West Side Highway pasting up signs that said, drive like your son lives here. And it just struck me that it was an opportunity for us to do something. So I'm glad that we worked with the State Department of Transportation, because it is a state highway, officially, not city. And they were very open to suggestions we had in terms of making that highway safer. But, I'll say this. The whole paradigm of highway design and roadbed design is based on car traffic and moving vehicles and how vehicles turn, and not about pedestrians or cyclists or folks who are recreating or who walk along the West Side Highway for pleasure. So that's the paradigm we need to change. And once we do that, and it's actually something I think we should definitely investigate.
Do you think
we can begin to take on those bigger issues?
Do you think that that's because we're big cyclists and we're big on retaking the streets? And I think one of the things that's frustrating, you know, we live in Manhattan, right? And we live here and we walk our kids here and our kids go to school here and we don't own cars. And it's frustrating when I can barely get my stroller down the street because there's, you know, two lanes of parked cars that are just enjoying free parking on the side of the street. But it does feel like there needs to be this reimagining of what the city is. And it felt like we were having some momentum under Bloomberg in terms of like updating the bike lanes and introducing City Bike. Do you think this is something, I mean, it's going to take a lot of New Yorkers to completely change how they live. How many people here have a car? None of you. You are good Democrats. These are good Hell's Kitchen Democrats. But this is, you know, this is interesting to me because this is a controversial issue amongst liberals. People are so, you know, climate change, we need to fix it, right? We think that we have all of this momentum, and yet you go to a community board meeting and it's all these people saying, but my car, but my parking space, but my, you know, it is changing this old way of thinking. Do you think it's possible?
Well, it's, you know.
What's the word on the street?
The word on the street is what you began this conversation with, is voting. And it's about making this a political issue, taking this to the ballot box, supporting candidates who support, you know, sensible street design that favors cyclists and pedestrians over vehicles, cars and trucks. I mean, that's really what it's about. So we're going to win this fight at the ballot box. But in the meantime, we can do things like lower speed limits. We can create, you know, crosstown bike lanes. Outside of my office, Cody, there was a young man with two children.
Dan Hangman, right?
Yes. Struck and killed. And my staff witnessed his death. And now there's a protected bike lane, which is too little, too late. But at the very least, we are looking at this issue. Vision Zero is a sensible plan. We just got to put some, you know, gas in the tank, so to speak, and make sure that voters are driven to the polls on this type of issue.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's tricky because we live in New York City. We have a liberal government here, and we I mean, you know, I remember when de Blasio was running for mayor and he made some comment like maybe we could rip up the Times Square pedestrian plazas, and that was the one like red flag that maybe he wasn't going to be super safe streets friendly. And then this week we have him saying that maybe we should have helmet laws, which have been proven to decrease the number of people that cycle, and the herd mentality and the safety of numbers is more important than wearing a helmet. I wear a helmet, but you know, we don't want to have barriers to people using City Bike. And then also the cyclist licensing. He sort of got baited by some Bike Lash person into, you know, saying these things this week. And it's just frustrating that we are in the most liberal city in the world, and it feels like, I mean, you used to be head of a community board too, and what do you think about the community board process in terms of the DOT knows what can be done to make the streets safer, but it's held up by sort of a NIMBY attitude of community boards?
Well, I think it comes down to the fact that you have a lot of, you know, automobile drivers who are on community boards. It's as simple as that. It's like, you know, people represent their self-interest more often than not. And if you have a car, and let's say in my neighborhood, you're an old-time villager, you know, you look for that free space to park, and it's like a ritual that you kind of have, you know, handed down from generation to generation.
Yeah, I mean, you know? I don't know if people who are listening to the podcast know, but people will spend 2 hours every Tuesday and Thursday in a ritual where they move their car out, and so then somebody, they can do a street sweep, and then they move their car back, and it's also that they can go to Costco once a month. Like, honestly, it's insane. It's insane.
You know, and you do hear some counter arguments, to be fair. You know, old folks, you know, people who can't use the subway, people who commute. But I think the big sea change that's on the horizon, that again would not have happened without a Democratic Senate, is congestion pricing. I honestly am like shocked that it passed, given that it failed under Bloomberg, and you know, and given that like the city administration was rather ambivalent about its
passage.
Tapazio
wasn't for it initially.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
The subway just got so bad, right? Is that why it happened?
I think that's right. But, you know, the ancillary benefit, of course, is that we're going to have less congestion, less carbon emissions, fewer trucks, and it's going to be safer. So you're absolutely right. It was the crisis of the MTA that brought congestion pricing back. But, you know, maybe at the end of the day, that's what was required. So I think it's going to result in a big change that we're going to see in the next few years.
So you guys got a lot done this year, and it was we interviewed Assemblyperson Rosenthal in this room right before the session was about to start.
I heard she was very funny.
She was good. You're doing
yes.
All right, though, Brett.
Yes.
Yeah, you guys can have a competition, and we'll judge you at the end.
Just drink three more beers, and then
right,
you'll definitely
I know.
Be...
three beers in.
It was right before the session. I sort of grilled her and like, are you going to get this done? Are you going to get this done? Are you going to get this done? And most of it got done.
Yeah.
Now, the one thing that didn't get done, or probably a lot of things are still on your list, but adult use marijuana didn't happen.
Yeah.
Do you think it's... Why didn't it happen? Do you think it's going to happen next year? Is it because people in Long Island don't smoke weed? Like, why? Like, constituents of people in Long Island and Westchester don't smoke weed? Like, what happened?
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of Long Islanders smoke weed. But, they need to go out and vote. That's the issue. So I think our recreational marijuana population in Manhattan, for example, you know, they're pretty engaged.
Charlie and I have said, I don't understand why somebody just doesn't run for president and just say, weed 2020. Like, you want to beat Trump? Just run weed 2020.
I mean,
like, Andrew Yang is doing a pretty good job just by saying, I'm going to give you $1,000 a month, right?
Yeah.
I think Elizabeth Warren just needs to say, I've got a plan for everything, and by the way, legal weed.
Weed.
And I think we'll run away with it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, so, you know, I hope that commonsensical approach, the idea of decriminalization of it is important.
And that did get done,
that
right?
That did get done. And not only did it result in records being, sealed, but it went farther, records being expunged. It's the first time it's happened in New York State history that a criminal record is going to be destroyed. So that's huge, huge. So credit to and my colleagues, Andre Stewart-Cousins and Jamal Bailey, who's the Codes Committee Chairman, Liz Krueger, who wants to tax the hell out of weed. She's the finance chair. So,
but it makes sense. It's so
right?
much money.
She sees, she sees anything that moves, and it's taxable. For the rest of us, she takes a look at it,
and everybody
that.
Would be more than happy to spend more money on their weed, or probably it was still going to be cheaper. You know what I mean? And not
right.
have to. Anyway, it's right. It seems like
and,
a no-brainer.
You know, I don't think anyone's worried about in my neighborhood. Those who might be selling weed in Washington Square Park. You know, that's. it's time that we monetize this habit. And regulate the hell out of it, make it safer for everyone, and actually have some public good in the terms of tax dollars that could come from it.
But we still hope that everybody drinks beer from Single
yes.
Cut Brewery, an amazing beer.
Well, they'll have CBD infused beer, I'm sure, or THC infused beer. Today was the first day of school. We dropped our child off at kindergarten today. And we left him there. He's still there.
He's pick still
up,
there.
Pickup was 3.
Are we supposed to pick him up?
Yeah, 3 p.m. It's not an overnight situation.
We thought we were cool until
That's
June.
That's a rookie mistake.
Happens to everyone.
So our child took the gifted and talented test earlier this year when he was 4. He did not pass.
No. He nailed it. He is the smartest little bug. If he's listening to this, we feel that you are the most talented person in other ways, and I didn't test well either, and you got that from me, and I'm sorry.
Well, maybe he's gifted but not talented, or one or the other.
But I bring up GNT because de Blasio had a panel that was, I think, investigating.
And that's not Gin and Tonic.
Not Gin and Tonic. Not Gin and Tonic. I bring up Gifted and Talented because recently a panel that had been appointed by the mayor made a recommendation to get rid of this the Gifted and Talented program in New York City schools. And it did, and it does seem, for those that don't know, four-year-olds take a test where they match shapes and do word problems. And we're the, I think we're the only city in the country that's that test at the four-year-old level. It is a little bit silly. And what?
It's the really the only entry point. They do, you can test your children later, but because there's so few slots in a gifted and talented program, that really basically the only entry point is when you're 4 years old. And that's very, very different than other parts of the country.
Right, but our privileged son not getting GNT is not really the point of this conversation. It's more the fact that the existence of the GNT program has decimated a lot of lower income schools and less thriving schools because people move away from those schools. They try to have gifted and talented programs in some districts that are maybe not thriving or not as demographically well off, and then they don't have enough kids that qualify for it, so they end up having to close it. So I'm curious. I don't know. The mayor has kind of not said what he's going to do with what this panel said, but this is going to be a big sea change if they change it. And I'm curious if you know, you have kids in public schools here. I'm curious if you have an opinion on it.
Wait. You're like, I'm curious, did your daughter do well on the
test? She was talented but not gifted.
Cool. Yeah. That's all we wanted to know. Yeah, we can move on.
Yeah. The way I see it is that why not have more opportunities for kids? The issue is not gifted and talented, like, and getting rid of it. The issue is, like, expanding it in more school districts and giving more children more opportunities. So throwing the proverbial baby out with the bathwater doesn't seem to be the right approach. It seems a little, like, heavy-handed and, like, I understand the sentiment that you want to, like, equalize education. But you don't want to, like, make it all mediocre, right? You want to have aspirational goals for kids and in every neighborhood. That's the issue. That does not exist in every neighborhood. So like, we privileged West Siders have those opportunities. Well,
for sure.
Folks in Bed-Stuy don't. And that's what we need to fix.
Well, what's frustrating to me, and like, we had gifted and talented in where I grew up in Ohio, but it was like, okay, you start kindergarten, you start first, you get fast tracked to the fast reading group, then like by fourth or fifth you can take a test, but also it's recommendations by your teacher. It says like, you've stood out and you should be in gifted math or gifted whatever. And so it's not just this one entry point that you have that determines. I mean, the test itself is, first of all, it's insane because you have to know about the test. So this, you have to know about the test before your kid even starts school. Brad has opened a beer and it's spilling all over him, and it feels very frat boy, and I love it more than anything. I love the fact that we are chugging beers with our state senator. It makes me so happy.
We're not frat boy. Gay frat boy.
Thank you. Aren't most frat boys?
There's not a difference.
Well, sorry, guys. Everyone's a little bit gay.
Gay, at different times.
Sure, exactly. Yeah. It's college. That's what it's for. It just feels a little like, okay, you have to know about the test. You have to take the test. Half of the test is just being able to sit and listen to one person talk to you, which a lot of kids aren't able to do it for. It just feels very archaic and weird, and shouldn't it be more of a, like, a merit-based thing where you can move people
that
need more attention into... And maybe you're right in terms of, like, opening it up, and so there is more opportunity.
So you have this, what has happened in our public school system is that what they call creaming, where the...
This also sounds like a frat boy term.
I know.
All right.
And it has nothing to do with that, but the best students in many of these struggling public school districts are going to charter schools. So if you're going to stay in the traditional public school system, we're going to need incentives for smart kids who have motivated parents to do so in these lower performing districts. If we do not create opportunities in these lower performing districts like G and T. I'm concerned that we're going to surrender the, you know, excellence in struggling school districts to the charter schools. So it's something I feel very strongly about. I believe that charters need a lot more scrutiny. Charters need a lot more accountability, and we need to invest in our traditional public schools. And one way to do that is through G&T. So I think that right. Chancellor really is taking an approach in this task force that, you know, in the long run, isn't going to help the struggling school districts.
But do you think that we should all just trust that Betsy DeVos knows what she's doing and she's going to fix it? Because that's sort of just where I'm at.
I know.
Blackwater, I mean, 2020.
I have legislation that I hope to move next session that would, you know, really shine a spotlight on charter schools and basically make them run through, jump through the same hoops that our traditional public schools have to. There is no reason why they don't have to. And as an elected official, I don't have access to the record keeping, to the data, to you know, to the private fundraising information that I would have with the traditional public school.
I mean, we don't even know that the teachers don't have to have the same training. Nothing, correct? I mean, it's wild, wild west.
It is a whole different world, and I get it that they are, you know, the creation of charter schools was meant to be a laboratory for the rest of our public school system. But it hasn't happened that way. In fact, it's been the opposite. The charter schools have become very, you know, have jealously guarded their secrets for the most part. And they've created this wall, in many cases literally, where they co-locate with traditional public schools, where they have nice classrooms and restroom facilities and gyms. And the traditional public schools, you know, have, you know, really, really poorly maintained facilities.
Lead paint. That just got cleaned up.
Yeah. So I mean, we're in a real, you know, juncture where we can correct this situation and return charter schools to what they were supposed to be, which was like an opportunity for public schools to learn from different methodologies and practices in teaching, and make that beneficial for the rest of the, you know, 1.1 million school children.
One more school-related question that's in the news. This Monday will be the very first meatless Monday in the New York City public school system. The breakfast and lunch that's served at schools will have no meat in it, an attempt to be healthier and better for the environment. And I'm curious, this is sort of a unique opportunity for government to sort of legislate vegetarianism or promote less meat. I'm wondering if there's any other opportunities for government to have an influence on meat consumption, or if you think that's something that you wouldn't want to touch.
And I've already touched it.
Have you realized that Charlie is a cycling vegetarian?
I love it.
Who likes beer?
Okay. One of my more reliable Assembly partners, Dick Godfrey, and I passed a bill that would require hospitals to offer plant-based food to their patients.
So that was you could be in the hospital laid up for a week and not have a vegetarian option?
There will be no such thing as mystery meat if this bill passes.
Wow.
Once signed into law, it'll be, you know, mystery tofu, but it is
essentially what mystery meat is. It's just a hybrid of some sort of filler and soy product.
So absolutely. I think this is an area of, you know, public policy and policy making that we need to explore further. I'm really glad that the public school system is, you know, following suit. So we need to look at other areas in our public life where we can, you know, let's face it, it's a better sustainable approach to our lives.
Have you tried the Impossible Whopper? Our podcast is also sponsored by the Impossible Whopper.
It is?
No.
Oh, I wish. I haven't had one yet. Please send
a
Whopper.
I haven't either. I went to a Burger King. I was with my husband, and where were we? We were in Roanoke, Virginia, and where my mother lives, and we went to a Burger King drive-through, and they didn't have it yet. And they said they would get it in like 15 years. So, but look, what I mean, I'm still like grappling with this whole chicken sandwich war.
Have you had the Popeyes one?
No, but there's apparently like lines outside, you know,
I don't
the Popeyes
know. I
in Midtown
had any
near
of
my
them.
Office.
I literally was like, how do you find out how things are trending? I asked Charlie, I was like, what's this chicken sandwich situation? How do I find out? I see people talking about a chicken sandwich. I don't know what the deal is. I can't find it on Twitter. It's very difficult. Mm. Anyway, I don't know. I asked my husband.
Yeah, and I gave her the hot tip of Google it, and then she figured it out.
Thank you so much.
I am so proud that we've spent almost 30 minutes without talking about Donald Trump, but I'm going to ruin it right now because there's a couple of ways that you have intersected with Trump that I do want to talk about. And the first thing I want to talk about, Senator Hoylman, is that you have proposed the Tax Returns Uniformly Made Public Bill, acronym TRUMP, which is an act that prohibits New York State electors from voting for a presidential candidate who has not publicly released at least 5 years' worth of tax returns no later than 50 days prior to a general election. And this has not been passed yet, correct?
It was passed and signed into law in California.
Right, but in New York State,
no.
It has not been passed. Did you try? Did you attempt to get this passed this
oh,
past year?
Oh yeah.
And it didn't. And do you? And can you get it passed next
well,
year?
Well, what we did, and look, okay. In some ways, my lawyers would say that is the worst acronym ever because it sounds like you're targeting the president. I was like, well, that was kind of the point of the bill. Tax returns,
it would be great if you were like, oh, TRU.
Yeah, that's
oh,
such a coincidence.
Shit. That was an accident.
Holy moly. No. So my colleagues were uncomfortable with that bill, even though we were the first state in the nation to introduce a tax disclosure bill.
And then California leapfrogged you and did it.
California, no, actually, New Jersey passed it first. It was vetoed by Governor Chris Christie.
Mm,
shocking. And then it was passed in California. It was vetoed by Governor Jerry Brown. Yes. And then California persisted. And my good friend, who is a state senator from California named Scott Wiener, he and I were law school buddies in the gay legal organization called Lambda.
How big is that group?
That's like seven.
Okay.
And hopefully it's grown. But he and I collaborated on this bill. So I said, Scott, you need to pass this bill because I can't do it because I was in the minority at the time. And he passed it right away, and then it was vetoed. But then he's passed it again, and Jerry Brown has signed it into law. So,
or Gavin Newsom signed it?
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Thank you. Governor Newsom signed it into law. So now... in New York, instead of that bill, which was not moving, I came back with another bill along with David Buchwald, who's an assembly member from Westchester County, that would release all tax returns of all statewide officials by the state of New York. So that was kind of like a summary, like your tax returns are being released whether you like it or not. My colleagues didn't like that either. Maybe that hit too close to home. So the third pass at this type of Trump tax legislation was the bill that we created that would allow New York to share the president's tax returns with the Congressional Investigative Committee if the Congressional Investigative Committee has made that request of the IRS. And that's exactly the scenario we're in. The House Ways and Means Committee has requested Donald Trump's tax returns from the IRS. They have said you do not have that power, even though it's expressly, you know, an Article I power. And our legislation allows New York to provide those returns.
Well, and Trump is suing over this, is that correct?
Trump is suing.
I mean, he sues over everything that happens to him, period.
I'll tell you what's disappointing.
He's suing the state of Alabama right now, by the way, for not having a hurricane.
Yeah. This is what's disappointing.
Sidebar, we have to talk about Sharpie Gate at some point, because I literally have not laughed that hard in my entire fucking life. I have not laughed as hard as just thinking of this doddery old man and taking a fucking Sharpie and just like including a state that wasn't included. on an old map, by the way. It was a very old map that saw it going across the panhandle. Anyway, I have not laughed that hard in a while, and it's not funny, but it's so funny, you know?
Well, so the long and short of it is Congress can get these returns from the state of New York. Trump has filed a lawsuit. We're challenging it through Attorney General Tish James. It'll be an important question to be answered.
But tomorrow, could Jerry Nadler tomorrow ask for it and you'll give it to him?
Well, here's the thing. Congress never asked for it.
So why didn't Jerry Nadler ask for it?
Well, it wouldn't have been Jerry Nadler because he's judiciary. It would have been it would have been Chairman Richard Neal of the Ways and Means Committee. He never asked for it. You know what? I'm disappointed because we were literally serving up the president's tax returns on a silver platter and they were not requested.
Have you seen the president's tax returns?
You know, that's the whole point of this legislation. No one has. And so
I know there's like one person sitting in the cubicle who's like, oh shit, yeah. I got it. Yeah. I'm going to get drunk and tell someone at a party.
Yeah. So we'll see. You know, I'm hopeful that this lawsuit can move quickly, but time is running out. And
right. So if you passed the Trump Act in when the session starts, was that February?
Yes, we passed it.
Could you get it done in time for?
Well, they had the opportunity to get it done. The bill was signed into law by Governor Cuomo, so it was available to Congress. So you'd have to ask Richard Neal why the hell he didn't.
Well, but this them. So this is an interesting thing. This is a local politics thing. Can people who are in Richard Neal's district just bombard the shit out of him and tell him to ask for it?
You know,
I mean, there's so many little tricks and weird things in Washington, I feel like, that we don't know about. I mean, you know what I mean? Could that be something that we just bug him about and maybe he just does? Or is he not doing it because of some other reason? I don't know.
No, I don't understand congressional politics. I have enough, you know, problems understanding my own local politics, but it's a good question. Like, what is, like, impeachment, you know, tax returns, you know, confronting the, you know, what is the strategy here? I think we all as Democrats have a real responsibility to keep asking those questions and keep pressuring our legislators, our members of Congress. What is the plan, guys? We got to defeat this person who is destroying our democracy.
But in terms of the Trump Act, in terms of the not being able to be on the ballot in New York State, is it too late for that because you come back in session in 2020?
No, it's absolutely not too late.
So you have to pass it quickly.
I have a glimmer of hope. But granted, there is now a lawsuit in California. But, you know, we all have to, like, we have to say something about Jerry Nadler. I heard the best description of him the other day. Someone at a local political meeting called him the general counsel for the resistance. And it's true. So, like, when I thought about this bill, you know, I ran it by Jerry, you know, and Jerry is really my North Star on all matters impeachment related. And I think he's got I just wish that more people in the congressional leadership were listening to him. I hope they are. I mean, I don't know, but I hope they are.
This next subject is maybe the most wonky thing that has ever been brought up in this podcast, but this is a pretty wonky room, and I think it's relevant. No, this is very, very wonky, and I apologize to people listening at home who this is too wonky or local for, but I want to talk about fusion voting. You, on your Twitter bio, I saw, Brad, that you list both the Democratic Party and the Working Families Party. Now, Governor Cuomo is pushing to end fusion voting, and that's where candidates can run on multiple party lines. So when we vote for you, we can vote. We can choose Brad Hoyman, the Democrat, or Brad Hoyman, Working Families Party. And it seems like Cuomo or some people in state government are trying to get rid of that. What are the pros and cons of fusion voting?
Well, look, the pros, I think, are pretty clear that you have a kind of an opportunity to not just vote for a Democrat, but vote for a left-wing Democrat, you know, and that has made the party, I think, a better, you know, force for good, because I know as an elected official, like a lot of my colleagues who run on the WFP line, the Working Families Party line, how many votes we get on that line. So it's a chance for us to
so it has an effect. Like if I vote for you and I do WFP rather than Democrat, you're actually seeing that, and
absolutely,
you're maybe pressured to be further to the left.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so it's like instead of voting for Nader, I'm going to vote for Al Gore, but I'm going to say you're on notice, Al Gore.
That's right.
That's a 2000 reference, guys. Guess what? We had the election stolen from us.
That's right. That's right. And you know, it's you know, and we have the WFP as putting good pressure on Democrats. You know, they led the effort against the IDC, for example. If we had just left it to mainline Democrats, that may have never happened. And we'd probably still have a Republican-controlled Senate.
If you don't know, the IDC was like a fake Democrats who were caucusing with the Republicans.
So, you know, there were a lot of institutional forces, including many unions, who supported IDC members, including many Democrats in both chambers and different legislative bodies across the state of New York, who, you know, it was a complete fake out, and the WFP, you know, smoked them out. So that's what's good about fusion voting.
So is there anything bad about it? Why is it sort of on the chopping block?
The bad thing about it is on the right, because, you know, it seems that there's been a lot of pressure for Republicans to capture both the Republican line and the conservative line, for example. And the conservative line has been, you know, it's an extreme line, you know, anti-gay, anti-choice, anti-immigrant. So it has pushed politics on the right farther right. That's why for the last decade or longer, we didn't have a single LGBTQ bill considered by the state Senate, because the Republicans were running scared from conservative party challenges because of fusion voting.
So do you support getting rid of it?
No. I mean, look, I think the benefits far outweigh
the negatives. Okay.
I think, and I'm a proud WFP member till I die. So, you know, I'm hopeful that this won't even be an issue.
Yeah.
There's a commission that was going to look at the proposal to end fusion voting, but I don't think it has a lot of support in my Senate Democratic conference.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because it sort of feels like a lot of the problems that we have in our government now are because we have two parties, right? So, I mean, is this, obviously these are parties that are in name only, essentially, right? Like you are a Democrat, you're Working Families Party, but also you're a Democrat, right? But it is interesting. It's interesting to think about, like, it feels weird that we have such a divisive group of Americans, and yet we're forced to be in between these two parties
you
sometimes.
You know, what also concerns me is this kind of corrosive approach toward politics, that if the WFP, you know, didn't support you, mm-hmm, then let's get rid of fusion voting. That seems almost Nixonian.
Cynthia Nixon is why this thing is being investigated, right?
You know, I mean, come to your own conclusions, but it doesn't seem like we as legislators should be trying to extinguish a political voice that maybe opposes some of our, you know, allies in the Democratic Party.
So you mentioned gay and trans rights. One thing I wanted to ask you is there was the gay and trans panic bill that you got passed. Can you explain a little bit about what that is?
Yeah, it's a crazy scenario that in the state of New York up until this year, it was actually a defense to murder that your victim was...
I'm sorry, Florida or New York?
Yeah, New York.
Okay, that's weird.
Defense to murder that your victim was gay or trans.
So basically it was like, I killed somebody, but I was scared because he was gay, was like maybe a reason you could get off?
Yeah, or maybe have a lighter sentence. So we, with the governor's help, to his credit, and Assemblymember Danny O'Donnell, that's now no longer possible.
That's great.
I mean, I'm kind of like, you know, it's so obvious.
It's insane.
I think we deserve a groan for having like waited so long
I
to
know.
Get rid of it.
Especially
but
because
nevertheless,
there
it's
are so many
victory.
Women that are behind bars for killing men that were literally threatening them with guns, boyfriends and husbands who were threatening with the guns, and they're, it's like, well, you still go to prison forever because that's just a yeah. man. So you know, you shouldn't be afraid of him anyway. Collective sigh.
One more school-related question, which is I want to talk about vaccines briefly, which we...
I just want to say I love... Thank you for being such a sport. We get you drunk, and then we're like, let's get in the weeds.
tipsy, not drunk. New York City this week was declared measles-free. Hey, that's good news. So we've been a 42-day period without the virus, which is like two incubation periods or something like that. So New York City, as of now, is measles-free. That could change when someone travels somewhere else and brings measles back here. But there are 26,000 unvaccinated children in New York State who are starting school and are because of new legislation that's been passed, I believe, are not allowed to go to school this week. So what's going to happen to them? Are they just being turned away?
Well, here's the deal. New York State was the epicenter of the worst measles outbreak in a quarter century.
Yeah, we had a baby during that. It was terrifying because our baby is not old enough
pregnant.
To be. I was pregnant and we had our son who was not old enough to be vaccinated yet. So I was walking around New York City. If someone coughed, I was like, get away from my son.
It's so true. And that's exactly what.
How terrible is that to just be like looking at someone on the subway like, do you have the measles?
it was horrible. And it resulted in so much suspicion among communities and so much divisiveness. Yeah. And you've got this population of you know, in many cases, well-meaning parents who are being misled by reading stuff on the internet.
Yes.
And you shouldn't get your medical advice from the internet.
I am on the Upper West Side Moms Facebook group, also the Hell's Kitchen Moms Facebook. I'm on a lot of Facebook moms groups. But the amount of people that were like, hey guys, just curious, do you think I should vaccinate my kids? Was insane to me that you would ask a fucking mom's group if you should vaccinate your child. What does your doctor say?
What does your doctor say?
Why are you asking a bunch
what
of mothers if you should vaccinate your
That's
children?
Exactly right.
I mean, I just was like, listen, everyone can have their own opinion about whatever, but if you're reaching out to a group of moms on the internet asking medical advice, what the fuck, what is wrong?
So we had 1,000 cases in New York and we weren't doing anything about it. So, you know, in California, when they had 135 cases, we had 1,000, they had 135 cases, they passed legislation that would end what was called the religious exemption, where somebody could just say, my religion says I can't be vaccinated. And, you know, the First Amendment does not extend to endangering the lives of your children, or worse, the lives of someone else's children, or someone who might be pregnant or immunocompromised.
Right. So, there's so many kids with cancer that attend public school. Why should they be threatened by the measles because you think it's not a big deal? It might not be a big deal for your relatively healthy child. I mean, it might be a terrible thing, and you might decide that you want to put them through that pain, but you're endangering the lives of babies, of people who have immune system compromises.
But here's, stepping a few feet back and looking at this issue, it's bigger than even vaccinations. It's about the anti-science mentality that is permeating across our country.
Because it is a left and right issue.
It
That's
is.
What's so fascinating to me about the vaccine issue, that it is anti-science, anti-government, like a conspiracy theory mentality that is just as bad on the left as it is on the right. People, it's in the same breath, people who are complaining about Donald Trump and Pizzagate, who also are against vaccinating their children because they read something online that said, if you vaccinate your children, they're going to I be autistic. I don't understand. I don't know what.
I will say that, you know, there seem to be a lot more Trumpers, you know, attacking me online and social media, who are anti-vaxxers than actual Democrats. I think, and it was a Democratic Senate and a Democratic Assembly that got this done. I don't think it would have happened with the Republican Senate. They actually voted against the bill. You know, in defense of, you know, what they claimed was religious freedom. So this is a distinguishing feature between Democrats and Republicans. We believe in climate change. We believe in vaccinations. We believe in abortion rights, protecting the health and well-being of the mother and the child. We believe in banning conversion therapy because the science shows that it hurts kids. It is a difference that we have to, as Democrats, continue to make clear to our voters.
By the way, shout out, applause break. I also wanted to give a shout out to the South Carolina man who ran a conversion therapy clinic for years and years who came out as gay this week. Got to give it up for that guy.
Bless his gay soul.
So, Brad, we're wrapping up. I want to ask you, as we asked Assemblyperson Rosenthal this in before the last session, we're a little ways away from next year's session, but I'm curious, what are you looking forward to next session? What is on your agenda next session? What do you think are the big legislative goals for the Democratic majority in 2020?
Well, you've mentioned one. I mean, clearly, you know, legalizing recreational weed is a big deal.
Weed 2020.
Yes. There you go.
You guys can steal it, guys.
There you go. You know, I have a bunch of bills, you know, with colleagues on everything from, you know, banning more plastics, you know, and protecting our oceans, making certain that we continue to build on our affordable housing goals by stopping people from exiting Mitchell Llama across the city. And keeping those for future generations. I have legislation that would continue to protect transgender folks, you know, giving them the opportunities, you know, to change their gender markers without having to go to a physician to do so. You know, I want to continue to ensure that, you know, LGBTQ families can have children through surrogacy. We're one of only two states in the country where surrogacy is illegal. It's crazy to me that we're not raising the standards for protecting surrogates and egg donors, but we have to work on that. And then on criminal justice reform, you know, in New York State, we're one of only three states where we don't have data about how many people were killed by the police. So I carry legislation called the STAT Act that would make that public and routine. And so there's a lot of issues that we continue to work on. It'll be different next year because we did make, you know, because of Andrea, Stuart Cousins, and Carl Hasty and that great collaboration between the Assembly and the Senate, we were able to pass so many bills. As we go into an election year, it's going to be a little different because people are going to be like looking at, you know, what's the public, you know, anticipating and what's their reaction going to be on our legislation. But I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that we'll continue to make strides.
It sounds like you have a lot of work to do. Last question. What's the most amazing part of Lewisburg, West Virginia? Charlie and I were just there this summer at a wedding. And it's the coolest small town in America? Or the most beautiful small town in America?
Coolest.
That's what the sign said.
The coolest small town in America.
So what's your favorite thing about Lewisburg, West Virginia?
Brad is from Lewisburg, West Virginia.
I'm from Lewisburg, West Virginia. Okay. If you went, this is the coolest thing for me. If you go to the local high school, the local junior high school, when I was in eighth grade, I'm kind of a failed artist, so I have like some ability to like create cartoons and such things. I'm not very good at it, hence I'm my job currently. But I was assigned by my eighth grade teacher to design the logo for the Lewisburg Junior High School mascot. And you know what the mascot was? The Senators.
Oh, wow.
That is the perfect ending to this podcast.
If you go there, you can see my handiwork.
I wish we had known. Shout out to my friend Mary C. Davis, who got married there. She's from there. We'll talk about this after the podcast. But
so did you just draw a picture of yourself? Is that the mascot?
No. Funny enough, it was a top hat.
Oh, it was a Republican.
A cane and two white gloves. I did not come up with a concept. I was just the draftsperson.
You're just illustrating it. Yes. Well, let's give a big round of applause for Senator Brad Hoylman. This has been great. We want to thank the Hell's Kitchen Democratic Club for hosting us again. We had so much fun doing this show here. We want to thank Single Cut Brewery for providing us some beer. And we want to encourage everybody listening at home and everybody here to vote in midterm elections. Thank you so much, everybody.
Charlie and a few of their friends chug a couple beers and talk politics. It's better with your two beers in.
This has been a UCB Comedy production. Check out our other shows on the UCB Comedy Podcast Network.